following program, X Squared Radio, is sponsored by Astral Magazine, America's source for the exploration of science and spirit. Check it out now at astralmagazine.com. My name is Verato, the editor, and I personally invite you to visit us at astralmagazine.com. That's A-S-H-E-V-I-L-L-E magazine.com. And now, enjoy X Squared Radio with Dr. Brooks Agnew.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Even though Hurricane Sandy is supposed to be bearing down on the East Coast, my AccuWindow forecast is clear skies and about 68 degrees, rather nice outside. X-Squared Radio is where the past meets the future. In here, all the results are positive, mathematically speaking. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. I know you might listen to other talk radio programs out there, but this program is a little bit different. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, and get ready, because we're about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Our phone lines will be open all night long. Well, for the next 3 hours anyway. At about midnight, I'm going to bed, so don't call me. But you can call me up till about then. Toll free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. We have three other call-in lines for international callers. 530-413-9537. 530-513-6472. Give those a call if you're outside the country. We also, courtesy of PBS Radio, have a new digital conference line. So if you want to duck out of the house for a couple of hours, do some Halloween shopping, you can listen on your cell phone by calling 805-399-1000. 805-399-1000, and then the passcode 769-608-pound. You do that, you'll be right here with us. Now, you won't be able to talk, but you'll be able to listen, which is, come on, you got to admit, about 70% of the fun here. So enjoy it. That's what our friends down at BBS Radio. By the way, if you have the idea of becoming a talk radio host yourself, you think you have what it takes, give me a... drop me a line at bagnew@x2-radio.com. And I will make sure that you get your shot. You can also, let's see, click on this link on Station 2 and it configures itself to any mobile device. Oh, we're going to have to make an app for that. I can't give you the link over the audio because it's too complex, but I'll get it to you in the coming weeks. Don and crew down at BBS Radio in Paradise, California are doing a great job. All you have to do is go to bbsradio.com and you can find it on Station 2. We're on Station 2 because we're late night, at least on the East Coast. I also want to give a shout out to my friends at Freedom Link Radio. They're doing a great job with the rebroadcast tonight, so I think it's actually a simulcast, so feel free to call in. I gave you the numbers, 888-429-5471. anywhere in North America. If you're out of the country, we have a lot of listeners in Australia. And I, by the way, I've been reading a book by an author. Actually reading some papers by an author, a professor in Australia, who has some insight on the arrival of Nibiru. And we're trying to get him on for an interview. I think it would be interesting. I think you would like to hear about it. I've got some information about it tonight. But I try to vet all of that because, you know, it's the subject of a lot of dichotomy on the internet. The solar wind tonight is 333 kilometers per second, and the proton count is 1 proton per cubic centimeter. There is a full moon coming tomorrow night. It's October 29th. And according to folklore, it has a special name. It's called the Hunter's Moon. Some Native American tribes gave it that name to mark the autumn hunt that topped off their food supplies for the coming winter. I think winter is going to come in like a lion this week with Hurricane Sandy, literally in a giant counterclockwise system is pulling cold air down from the Arctic. There's a magnetic canopy of a sunspot group just over the sun's southwestern limb. Slowly it erupted today. Aimed right at us, by the way, so it should arrive late Monday afternoon. Amateur astronomers, because, you know, we have to have amateur astronomers out there, all of the government telescopes around the world are contracted, paid for months, sometimes years in advance, different universities and affiliated groups that buy the time of those telescopes. But amateurs have great equipment, 8, 10, 12, and even 14-inch telescopes, set up with rather nice observatories piped into their computers. They're doing digital shots night after night. They have software that compares all the spots of light out there that their telescope gathers. And they're able to discover comets. And they've been keeping a close eye on comet 168P Hergenrother since October 1st when it suddenly brightened about 500-fold. From the 15th to 8th magnitude. At the same time, the comet was making its closest approach to the sun. It's about 1.4 astronomical units. Some observers speculated that solar heating caused the fragile comet to break apart. So a couple of days ago, a group of astronomers found evidence to actually support this idea. Using the Falk's North F-65 telescope, writes Ernesto Guido, we detected a fragmentation in comet 168P. There are three major sunspot clusters on the sun today. 1596, 1598, and 1599 are all visible with the naked eye, with the proper viewing equipment, of course. Don't go out there and peel back your eyelid and etch a giraffe on your cornea. I recommend an H-alpha coronoscope if you really want to have your mind blown. I mean, photographs are one thing. Even some digital YouTubes are not too bad. But once you settle your eye up against the eyepiece of a coronoscope and actually look at the live sun, you're going to have your mind blown. By the way, sunspot 1598 is still pointed directly at us. And there are multiple magnetic filaments ready to snap at any moment. Now, we have discussed many times on this program the need to get yourself prepared with food and water for a short time. Now, some say you will need a 2-year supply. I support that. I'm okay with that. If you've got a hacienda out there that's well established in the mountains or the deserts or, you know, a fairly defensible position, a 2-year supply is not a bad idea. And it may save your life, but it will most likely make you a target. For whom? Well, for the National Guard and the Red Cross, for a couple, and maybe even robbers, although I highly doubt the latter. Because if you didn't buy your food carefully with cash, the government knows you have it. I highly recommend a lightweight transportable food supply that you can move with a minimum of manpower. So you need to visit my friends No, not the ones that sell silver or gold or 401k plans or life insurance. I mean my friends that offer food as an investment. The food investor. Now, I've talked about it on this program a few times. I want to mention it now because we're coming into the time of season when people are considering buying Christmas gifts for their friends and family. If you're a parent and your kids have moved away or you're a grandparent, you might consider this. Instead of those high-tech electronic games, instead of some other gadget or toy or an article of clothing that will get hung in the closet 9 months out of any given year, depending on which season the clothing is designed for, why don't you buy them food? Now, I don't mean going down to Food Line or Kroger's or Aldi or something like that and buying food. I'm talking about food as an investment. If you go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com and click on the right-hand side where the banner says the food investor, you're going to get a special deal just for X Squared Radio listeners. It's a 72-hour kit that allows you to take care of yourself and maybe one other for 3 days. Now, it is so lightweight, it is made without preservatives, and it will last for 30 years. My friends Scott Barzee and Danny Morris out there in Utah have refined the science of food preservation without preservatives. So don't go buy that pasty stuff you get in the MREs. That's okay if you're a soldier. You have to take those orders. You might as well buy something that tastes great, looks good, it stays for 30 years, it's truly a set-it-and-forget-it food. Buy that. That's a real gift of life. So, I think you should also buy a good water filter. I use a ceramic filter and a carbon filter. You may be drinking from a neighborhood pond, you know, or a rain barrel for a while. If you live in a house with gutters, pre-plan a way to get the rainwater from your roof to a barrel to save it for drinking. You'll need both the ceramic and the carbon filter. The ceramic filter will take the bacteria and viruses out of the water, and the carbon filter will get the chemicals from your shingles and the air above your home out of the drinking water, and you can use it to make food or drink, and it makes about, my little filter makes about 2 quarts a minute, which is, or 2 liters a minute, actually, which is plenty if you're out there just trying to survive. By the way, today there was a 7.2 earthquake off the coast of British Columbia with a tsunami alert, but only a few inches of surge were realized. It was heading for Hawaii. It arrived, nothing to be alarmed about. It seems the planet, however, is experiencing a broad variety of small cataclysms internally and externally. In the news today, scientists have discovered that mice can actually sing in tune with one another. I never thought about that. You know, I got a degree in biology, and as such, going through immunology classes, I personally have put to death hundreds and hundreds of white mice by hand. And no, it's definitely humane. It's done in a way that doesn't, you know, make any pain to the mouse at all. You know, we're able to take care of it in a rather quick fashion. But I never thought about mice actually singing in tune. But scientists at Tulane University, with nothing better to do on their hands than listen to mice sing in the lab, recently discovered that mice can match the pitch of their voices to blend with one another. I thought that was only in the movie Babe. The findings came as something of a surprise to researchers who were drinking one late night in the lab. No, I added that part. Since mice were thought to be incapable of being able to change the pitch of their voices. Well, I can tell you one night our hamster got out. Back when I had little kids, you'll have to have little pets. And we had a hamster that got out of the cage and was running around the house one night, and so was our house cat. And the house cat saw the hamster run down the hallway. Well, that's just irresistible to see that stubby little tail wagging its way down the hallway. And so off goes the cat after the hamster. Well, you know, I didn't want to have Wild Kingdom reenacted in the master bedroom, so of course I chased the cat. And when I rounded the corner, what I saw was absolutely astonishing, something I should have caught on film. I didn't, so I have to describe it to you here. Up on its hind legs, with paws in the air like, okay, you got me, in front of this cat was the hamster, and it was screaming at the top of its lungs, one lungful after another. I never heard a hamster make any kind of noise other than a pleasing little whimper every now and then. This was amazing. It was loud and it was directed right at the cat. And it was sounded something like, you want a piece of this? You want a piece of this? Anyway, it was enough to make the cat stop dead in its tracks. Like, what the heck is this guy doing? He didn't even want to hit him with a paw. So wiping the cat out of the way and scooping the frightened, nearly catatonic hamster up off the floor, I returned it to its domicile safely. But the kids were amused. Anyway, the Telegraph reports, we are claiming that mice have limited versions of the brain and behavior traits for vocal learning that are found in humans for learning speech and in birds for learning song, said Dr. Eric Jarvis, who supervised the study. Though matching pitch and voice modulation are newly discovered in mice, which I find just stunningly epic, the concepts of mice singing is not new. Male mice reportedly emit a noise referred to as a song that is used to attract potential mates. Well, that's not uncommon. Scientists reportedly observed two male mice matching the pitch of their songs to one another while they were put in the same cage, a phenomenon that demonstrated a basic capacity for vocal learning in the rodents. Humans and bats, as well as other mammals and some species of birds, are the only animals to previously exhibit such a trait. Jarvis noted, in mice, the ability to match pitch don't exist at the advanced levels found in humans and song-learning birds, but they are also not completely absent as commonly assumed. According to the Telegraph, vocal learning in mice was affected when scientists took away a mouse's ability to hear or damage cells in the motor cortex of its brain. So interesting. I tell you, science is just fascinating. Would have never thought that about mice. I wonder what happens if you put four of them together. Is it like a quartet, do you think? They might harmonize? Just a thought. You know, oftentimes you've heard of the animal called a lemming. I mention it in my book, Remembering the Future, and also again in my book, Alienated Nation, because it's such a peculiar behavior that they exhibit. A well-connected source just secreted me a copy of the script of a piece called Lemmings at the Precipice of World War III. And if it plays out as currently written, it's guaranteed to be a horrible, horrible ending. For the lemmings, that is. The 1958 Disney documentary, White Wilderness, purported to show how furry little Arctic rodents called lemmings lived and died in a natural cycle of life and death, like suicide. The film convincingly told us how, when their numbers exploded and the local food supply was in danger of being unable to support them, nature, in all her wisdom, would inexplicably cause the little beggars to migrate to cliffs and to jump into the freezing Arctic waters. Those that survived the fall didn't turn back after being roused to their senses by the icy cold. Instead, they pressed on, a tangled mass of fur moving away from their natural element even to deeper waters and inevitably to death. The film was beautifully shot and edited, which earned the producers an Academy Award as a documentary film. It was all very compelling, great eye candy, but it was a complete, total, and absolute fabrication. Sometime later, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation did a follow-up documentary called Cruel Camera. The evidence was presented showing how the entire screenplay was staged. The Lemming actors were actually imported from Hudson Bay to Calgary, Alberta, and herded across the foreign tundra. Scene after gripping scene had been carefully staged to dazzle the viewers until at last, perched atop a high precipice on the edge of the Arctic Sea, the poor creatures, like sheeple to the slaughter, were plopped onto a rapidly spinning turntable and flung from the heights into the tossing waves. The close-ups, the drama, life and death in full color was beautifully narrated to convince us that it's nature's way, and we the viewers must accept it, nature's wisdom at work in the world around us, if you gentle viewers will believe it. We have been and are being conditioned to believe a lie, to calmly accept what is purported to be the inevitable. While the eyes of most Americans watch the political made-for-TV series Presidential Debate 2012, the trailer for the biggest James Bondsonian type of screenplay ever produced, Middle East on the Road to Armageddon, just showed in a theater near you. A well-connected source just secreted me a copy of the script, and as I said, if it plays out as currently written, it's guaranteed to be a horrible ending. This mega-budget action-adventure film has been in production for some time and is soon to be released, possibly just in time for the holidays. The writers and directors have been tweaking and honing the script to fit some recent on-location filming opportunities. This is just an important production that most of the big-name actors will do anything to be in it. It's the stuff of legends. United Globalistas Studios, who've underwritten this production, want to keep a tight rein on the script because they don't want the twists of the plot and subplots leaked before the big premiere. But why? The studio moguls in this case are pretty darn smart. They know how everyone wants to be a star. So they are going to let U.S., the invited guests, have a part in the final scenes, which, surprise, surprise, they intend to shoot with a live audience. The studios are hoping that the invited participants remain calm, believing they will enjoy the satisfaction of a feel-good ending. Me? I see a turntable spinning in the distance. We are at the precipice of a global conflict, billed as World War III. The killing of Ambassador Stevens and other Americans in Libya was merely the prelude, like the opening scenes in a Bond film. But we haven't yet grasped how it relates to the rest of the script. During the, quote, Arab Spring, we thought we were seeing trailers for several different films before the main attraction, but little did we know how seamlessly the various clips all tie together at the end. But the show has already started. If the script proceeds as written, the entire geopolitical world and balance of power could, and most likely will, change with this next curtain call. No one will be left untouched by the upcoming events. So it is here that I pause and, with a sense of urgency, suggest that we all move back a few rows and open our gaze to the bigger screen before us. My well-placed source walked me there recently and showed me where to look for the hidden images in the big picture. It's difficult at first, but once you know what you're looking for, it suddenly pops out, and bam, it seems obvious. There is no way that one cannot see it. At his request, I cannot give him his proper and well-deserved attribution. But without his insight, I might have completely missed my aha moment and the instant, urgent, and extreme importance of the events taking place right now, right before us. Now, everyone knows, excuse me while I take a sip of water as you hang on the edge of your seat. Wonderful. World War III, everyone knows, will not start with Iran. Not even sort of. Maintaining the screenplay metaphor, like Bond, we will transit the world before the climactic final scene on that high cliff. But for now, the prelude takes place in and around Syria, not Iran, or even Israel. Just to give you a little heads up, because a lot of you don't know this, Syria is kind of a hinge pin of the Middle East. Now, it goes back a long, long, long way until it was once called Persia. But Syria is run by a minority party called the Sunni. That is, the Sunni are a minority in Syria, but they are a majority in Iran. The rest of Syria is Shia, a different sect of Islam. Who do you think the Shia are? Very good. Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is our ally. We built the world's largest oil companies in Saudi Arabia and one of the world's largest air bases is in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is our ally, both financially and militarily. Saudi Arabia wants Syria to be Shia. Iran wants Syria to continue to be governed by Sunni. And that is the struggle that you see. It is Syria and Russia versus the U.S. and NATO, with supporting actor roles going to the usual suspects, including, but are not limited to, Vladimir Putin, the world's richest and most powerful man, Barack Hussein Obama, Hillary Clinton, and of course the late Christopher Stevens. Oh, one more thing. Please reread and understand this references contained in this subheading, which are actually critically important to one's overall understanding of the events. Ambassador Stevens and the Syrian Red Line. We citizens are befuddled by Mr. Obama's insistence that members of his administration keep pushing an implausible and mercurial narrative about the events in Libya that resulted in the death of our fellow citizen heroes. The official nonsensible explanations have been easily refuted thus far, yet Presidente Obama and his czars continue to push illogical narratives. But why? Is the truth that dangerous? Seems to me that the only people who don't want the truth are the people with something to hide. What is it that you have to hide, Mr. President? To better understand what happened in Libya, you must first understand the context in which it took place. Ambassador Stevens was probably at least as valuable as a U.S. intelligent asset operative as he was a diplomat. He operated the Iran desk early in his career and eventually became one of our top go-to experts on all things Iran. Mr. Stevens served in countries throughout the Middle East before eventually settling in Syria for several years. He was well known and respected in the region. He fluently spoke the language, but he also understood the culture. He also lived in Washington, D.C. for several years while serving as the Director of Multilateral Nuclear and Security Affairs. His little black book with the contact numbers for the good and the bad actors and their agents had become pretty extensive. But here's where the plot thickens. Dun, 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 dun. It appears that Mr. Stevens might not have initially entered Libya to stop the flow of weapons, but to help funnel them under the direction of higher-ups in the Obama regime. He was tasked with coordinating, overseeing, and facilitating the movement of the rebel fighters from across North Africa through eastern Libya. The troops were armed with weapons from Gaddafi's extensive hidden arsenals and spirited to staging areas in the Syrian refugee camps in Turkey. That's clear enough. Everybody knows that. If this administration had needed to go to Congress over the last year and ask for money and troops to start a war with Russia on Syrian soil, do you think they would have gotten it? Not a chance. The electorate would never have put up with it. But this administration's handlers didn't need to. They just got creative. Does Iran-Contra come to mind, anyone? All they have done thus far is ask for a few paltry millions for administrative costs to support the Syrian freedom fighters. But enough of the charade. Let's be clear here. At this exact moment, we, the American people, are already directly engaged in an all-out proxy war with Russia. I bet you didn't know that. This is not and or will not remain at arm's length Cold War. This is already a hot war with tens of thousands of deaths in the last several months. This administration has taken sides and chosen its winner, sending money, arms, logistical and intelligence support to the Syrian freedom fighters. You know these actors, as you've seen them on the screen before. Check the credits. Their real names are the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda. They recently debuted in a theatrical Arab Spring, a local hit with recent appearances in Egypt, Tunisia, etc. And don't forget, the false flags are already a-blowing in the wind. Ambassador Stevens' last official meeting is reported to have been with Turkish Consul General. We know that for a fact. It occurred approximately an hour and a half before he was assassinated. And he wasn't just assassinated. He was brutalized and left to die. He was brutalized in the worst Islamic fashion. But a shot to the head would have been merciful, considering what he went through. They did not leave him dead. He died some hours later. It is interesting that this meeting occurred in Benghazi. Tripoli is the seat of power in Libya, and a meeting of this type could easily and more safely been arranged there. However, Libya is almost two countries now. Think East, West, Germany half a century ago. The eastern half is more closely aligned with the radical Muslim Brotherhood powers now in control in Egypt. The border is really a near invisible line drawn by some Western powers long ago and has little meaning to the locals. The Turkish consul general had to meet there, not just with our ambassador, but also the various factions shipping arms to Syria through Turkey. He was looking for assurances that none of the chemical WMDs still left in Libya after Gaddafi's demise had and or would touch Turkish soil. For several months now, the U.S. and NATO-aligned nations have been ratcheting up the hyperbole of the threat of Assad's chemical weapons stockpile. President Obama and Secretary Clinton have threatened repeatedly that if WMDs from Syria's arsenal are used or their security threatened, in other words, if it looked like the rebel good bad guys might capture a chemical weapons site from Assad's forces, it would result in an immediate need for extensive UN intervention. In other words, this administration is telling Mr. Assad, heads we win, tails you lose. No matter what happens, we will find a reason to bring the UN and Western troops into Syria. Might just as well accept the inevitable and give up. But wait, there's more. Unlike our other recent adventures in the region, chasing after loner states, this one isn't as alone as you might first have thought. It has some very mean-looking big brothers. Russia is hosted by the new and improved President Putin, along with an additional cast of favorites, China and Iran. Mr. Putin is making it very clear to the West that we have drawn a deep red line in the sand in Syria. If the U.S. and NATO should choose to cross it, World War III will start in Syria, not Iran. President Putin is convinced that the next act of this screenplay will contain some variation of a false flag event involving chemical weapons. He has not minced words warning Turkey, the little guy caught between a rock and a hard place, not to get involved. The Russian alliance thinks some of the munitions for this false, lying documentary might have already been spirited from Libya. And if I were Mr. Putin and couldn't overtly fly bombing missions over my enemy's supply lines, communications, or command centers, I'd probably try to do something covert that exposes my hidden enemies and brings them out into the open. Like any good KGB commander. It is interesting that the death of our ambassador has brought the Libya-Syria connections into the light of day. Who'd that benefit? Is this the truth that scares the someones with something to hide? Amazing, isn't it? How accurately those mortars were placed by those ragtag, spontaneous protesters. Is it possible that our arms-length conflict has now become a little more direct? Whatever the truth is, Turkey wants everybody off their soil. They want a buffer zone created across the border inside Syria, where the UN, the US, and NATO can care for the refugee population. They are conniving into this insane civil war. While the curtain is being forcibly closed on the unfortunate events involving Ambassador Stevens and his associates as the camera light batteries wear out and the rhetoric falls into the soup of politics, the stage is nearly set for the next act. We've seen the first glimpse of that act in the last several days. When a mortar was launched into Turkey and Turkey responded in kind, all that is needed now is for a dutiful media to present one image, a video, or some other proof that Assad or someone else is using or has in their hands unconventional weapons. This will provide the necessary pretext for the U.S. and NATO to intervene and ramp up the war against Assad. The UN will assist, and the red line will then have been crossed. Don't you hate it when your patriotic energy is twisted up in a jiu-jitsu-style move against you, your family, your country? Is it important to understand that Russia has upwards of 100,000 troops and advisors on the ground in Syria, and a significant contingent of their navy is parked in the Mediterranean from just down the street? Consider that against the historical backdrop of Vietnam, it's too long a conversation for now, but we need to have it soon. Current events have put Russia's back against the wall, and they intend to come out fighting. Consider what Mr. Obama has done at the behest of his Sunni Muslim handlers, facilitating change in the complexion of North Africa and all of the Middle East. Now visualize what the geopolitical landscape will look like should President Obama's handlers continue to push their pan-Arab United States of Muslims agenda. We can't fight what we refuse to see or understand what we accept even exists. Though the lemming lie was exposed long ago, the tale was so well told that even today the vast majority of our fellow citizens still believe it. The voice and words are still ringing in my ears. Remain seated. We will be on the ground shortly. The sounds and narration lull us into acquiescence. The camera's shots are well planned and the lighting and focus precise. To date, we've only seen directly and indirectly the subtleties the directors and editors wanted us to see. Don't you think it's time to say, stop the turntables? Somebody please turn on the lights in here. Let's refuse to be herded into this latest lying, fabricated documentary. We actors have been sold a bill of goods concerning who's behind this film and how it plays out. I don't want anybody doing voiceovers when they edit it later, making it look like I agreed with all this crap. Let's start moving to the exits and hope there are no hidden shooters or bomb throwers in the crowd. There is still time. I, for one, and I believe you too, refuse to believe that we have no choice but to dutifully, willingly allow ourselves to be plopped on that turntable for their horrific next scene. Turn on the lights. Stop the turntable. We'll have more on this in the coming weeks, if we have coming weeks. Our phone number tonight is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471, if you want to call in. I really appreciate the writing by Douglas Hagman and the comments on the article at the Canada Free Press. Well done, my friends. I have a little bit of stuff that I added in there just for information. More has come out on this in the last week, the emails that have been discovered. And really, I wrestled with even discussing it tonight, but in cruising around the various outlets of the media, I noticed that there are only one or two that are even covering this. So, in fact, I think there are some large networks out there that have yet to mention anything about Benghazi. Slowly but surely, the facts are starting to get out there to the people, but they're being so diluted and so obfuscated by the reporting and the opinions of the owners of the stations that you're not really getting the truth. So I decided to paint it for you in that manner. So, and there's a lot more I could cover, but I think you guys have had a good dose of it, and I want to move on to something else. By the way, you know, our good friends NASA, they designed the X-37B. We've discussed it a few times on this program. It's sort of a mini robotic version of the space shuttle. NASA was tasked to design it along with assistance from Jet Propulsion Labs out of Pasadena, and they did a good job with what technology they had and what budget they had, and they got to the point where they just plain ran out of money. And so, like most programs that are designed merely to spend taxpayers' money to see if they can develop another program, it was due to be scrapped. Enter the U.S. Air Force. And the U.S. Air Force decided to pick up where NASA and JPL left off. They applied their rapid deployment budget. A rapid deployment budget is sort of an open blank checkbook that keeps getting refilled with as much money as they need. There's also never any accounting, so no one really knows how much money is spent, where it's spent, who it goes to. None of that. None of that's necessary. We're the Air Force now. We've got this. We got the airplane. The U.S. Air Force's launch of the next secret mission by its unmanned X-37B spaceplane has been officially delayed to mid-November. We thought it was going to be going up here shortly on October 25th, but it has been delayed to November 13th. The delay was announced in an update by the mission's launch provider, United Launch Alliance, also known as ULA. ULA officials said an engine glitch during an October 5th launch of a Delta IV rocket that successfully orbited a Global Positioning System 2F3 satellite. So now we're going to have to rely on our friends down at Heavens Above. Heavens Above is a nonprofit monitoring organization that tracks virtually every can of aluminum that's up there in space. If you want to know when it's coming over and where it's coming over and which direction to look with your binoculars, you go to heavens-above.com and you can find it. They're the only ones that can tell us where the X-37B is going and where it's been. And when they actually launched it, and it went up for about 11 months, and then Heavens Above lost it. They couldn't find it. And what actually happened is the X-37B changed its orbit. Yes, that's right. It went out further and went into a different orbit. And just an amazing change of mission midway that the X-37B demonstrated that it could do. And it's a good thing that the folks down at Heavens Above were watching. So that's where we'll go when it launches on November 13th, and we'll just see where the little beggar's going. Also, we have heard that, there's another planet coming in, Planet X, Nibiru, a large asteroid, whatever. We have a good source down in Australia that says they can see it just before dawn, just a few seconds before the sun comes up over the eastern limb. He says that he can see the planet out there. He has also been grabbing the feed from Neumayer, which is a Arctic observation post. They routinely airbrush out this one image every day that they post this. And he just monitors it every day because he figures that one day the guy that's responsible for airbrushing that is either going to go home, or he's going to be on break, or he's going to sleep in or whatever. And sure enough, he did. And when the airbrushing was not there, there was the image of the planet headed our way. We can't see it in the southern hemisphere. You certainly can't see it in the northern hemisphere. You really have to be on the southern tip of Australia or on the Antarctic continent itself to be able to see it. You're not going to get on the Antarctic continent unless you're affiliated, that is to say, with a military mission or a university mission, and everything you say or do is highly classified. You're not going to leak anything off of there. However, mistakes are made. Everybody that's working down there is human, and they do make mistakes, and sometimes they broadcast something they're not supposed to broadcast, and that's what happened, and we'll try to get that image to you, and we'll try to get the person that saw it to come on the program, and we'll talk about it. But the idea is that this Planet X, Nibiru, Marduk, whatever, is going to come close enough that it's going to wreak havoc on the Earth, destroy the Earth. Well, not so easy. You know, destroying the Earth is a lot harder than you may have been led to believe. Have you seen the action movies, you know, where the bad guy threatens to destroy the Earth, you know, Death Stars? You've heard people on the news claiming the next nuclear war, or cutting down the rainforests, or persisting in releasing hideous quantities of chlorofluorocarbons or CO2 or methane into the atmosphere threatens to end the world. Well, it's not true. The Earth was actually built to last. It's 4.5 billion years old. It is 5 times 10 to the 18th tons ball of iron. It has taken more devastating asteroid hits in its lifetime than you've had hot dinners. And it still orbits nice and blue and merrily around our sun. So the first piece of advice is the Earth destroyer is going to have a much harder time than you think. There are some methods that have been thought of that would destroy the Earth, and I'd like to address those really quickly here. Total existence failure. Method. Well, there's no method. You simply sit back and twiddle your thumbs completely by chance. All 2 times 10 to the 54th atoms making up the planet Earth suddenly and simultaneously and spontaneously cease to exist. The odds against this actually ever occurring are considerably greater than a Googleplex to 1. Failing this, some kind of arcane probability manipulation device may be employed. So don't worry about total existence failure. Not likely. You find it hard for me to say not possible because, after all, I am a physicist and we are all about possibilities. The next one is we're gobbled up by strangelets. Well, first of all, you need a stable strangelet. Here's the method. You hijack control of the relativistic heavy ion collider in Brookhaven National Laboratory, Long Island, New York. You use this to create and maintain a stable strangelet, keeping it stable for as long as it takes to absorb the entire Earth into a mass of strange quarks. Keeping the strangelet stable, however, is incredibly difficult. Once it has absorbed the stabilizing machinery, but creative solutions may be possible. A while back, there was some media hoo-ha about the possibility of this actually happening at the relativistic heavy ion collider. But in actuality, the chances of a stable strangelet forming are pretty much zero. So that's about it for that one. The next one is sucked into a microscopic black hole. I'm sure you've actually considered this from time to time, walking down the street. First of all, you need a microscopic black hole. Note that black holes are not eternal. They evaporate due to Hawking radiation. Hawking radiation. Stephen Hawking, one of the world's most prominent physicists, he speculated that black holes can evaporate because they actually clone themselves and lose part of themselves into another dimension. For your average black hole, this takes an unimaginable amount of time, but for really small ones, it could happen almost instantaneously, as evaporation time is dependent upon mass. Therefore, your microscopic black hole must have greater than a certain threshold mass, roughly equal to the mass of, say, Mount Everest. Creating a microscopic black hole is tricky, since one needs a reasonable amount of neutronium, but may possibly be achievable by jamming large numbers of atomic nuclei together until they stick. This is called criticality. This is left as an exercise to the reader. The method is you simply place your black hole on the surface of the Earth and wait. Black holes are of much higher density. They pass through ordinary matter like a stone through the air. The black hole will plummet through the ground, eating its way to the center of the Earth and all the way through to the other side. Then it will oscillate back over and over like a matter-absorbing pendulum. Eventually, it will come to rest at the core, having absorbed enough matter to slow it down. Then you just need to wait while it sits and consumes matter until the whole Earth is gone. This is highly, highly unlikely. But it's not actually impossible. You just have to go capture a microscopic black hole and tow it to Earth. You'll need 2 × 10^12 tons of antimatter, the most explosive substance. The next one is to blow up the Earth with antimatter reaction. You'll need 2 × 10^12 tons of antimatter, the most explosive substance possible. It can be manufactured in small quantities using any large particle accelerator, but this will take some considerable time to produce the required amounts. If you can create the appropriate machinery, it may be possible and much easier simply to flip 2.5 trillion tons of matter through a fourth dimension, turning it all to antimatter at once. This method involves detonating a bomb so big that it blasts the Earth to pieces. How hard is that? Well, the gravitational binding energy of a planet of mass M and radius R is, if you do the lengthy calculations, given the formula E is equal to 3/5 gm to the second divided by r, the radius, for Earth, that works out to roughly 224 × 10^30 joules. A joule is a watt second. A watt second, a watt times a second. Come on, the secret to life is clean glassware and conversion factors, so keep up. The sun takes nearly a week to output that much energy, so you'd have to capture it all. So just think about that. To liberate that much energy requires the complete annihilation of around 2 × 10^12 tons of antimatter. That's assuming zero energy loss to heat and radiation, which is unlikely due to be the case in reality. You'll probably need to up the dose by at least a factor of 10 to compensate for that, for entropy and other things. Once you've generated your antimatter, probably in space, that'd be a safe place to do it, just launch it in mass toward Earth. The resulting release of energy, obeying Einstein's famous mass-energy equation, E is equal to mc squared, should be sufficient to split the Earth into 1,000 pieces. We might actually use that for an anti-asteroid bomb. That would be cool. Finally, we talk sometimes about being destroyed by a vacuum energy detonation. The tools you'll need is a light bulb. This is a kind of a fun one. Contemporary scientific theories tell us that what we may see as vacuum is only vacuum on average, and actually thriving with vast amounts of particles and antiparticles constantly appearing and then annihilating each other. It also suggests that the volume of space enclosed by a light bulb contains enough vacuum energy to boil every ocean in the world. Therefore, vacuum energy could prove to be the most abundant energy source of any kind, which is where you come in. All you need to do is figure out how to extract this energy and harness it in some kind of power plant. This can easily be done without arousing too much suspicion. Then, surreptitiously allow the reaction to run out of control. The resulting release of energy would easily be enough to annihilate all of planet Earth and probably the Sun as well. Oh, there's one more. We could be sucked into a giant black hole. I forgot about that one. First, of course, still, you need a black hole, extremely powerful rocket engines, and optimally a large rocky planetary body. The nearest black hole to our planet is 1,600 light years from Earth in the direction of Sagittarius, orbiting V4641. After locating your black hole, you need to get it and the Earth together. This is likely to be the most time-consuming part of this plan. There are two methods, moving Earth, or you can move the black hole. Though for best results, you most likely move both at one time. It's very, very difficult, but it's definitely possible. We see it all the time in space. You will need a powerful mass driver, and you'll need to be able to stand against something or push against something like a giant rocket engine pushing against the planet to get it to move that way. That's going to be pretty tough to do. That consumes, as a giant black hole would, our first hour. And next hour I want to talk about a shortage of doctors and some other stories. And in the middle of the second hour going on into third hour, I want to talk about a movie, actually a couple of movies that I've seen. One is called Loopers and the other is called Cloud Atlas. If you saw Cloud Atlas or you didn't see Cloud Atlas, you're going to be fascinated, very, very fascinated by this. Because, you know, this is just one of those subjects that just doesn't go away. We have talked about it, about ancient Christianity and other traditions, and we'll talk about it again tonight because it's fascinating. And these two movies, although Looper isn't about reincarnation, it's about time travel, but it has some good questions about the loop going on over and over again. But Cloud Atlas is nothing short of an epic work of art, and we're going to talk about it here in a little bit. So don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio right after my good friend sing this song, Hallelujah, by Leonard Cohen. Don't go away.
Hallelujah. Versions of that amazing prose by Leonard Cohen. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're in the second hour of X Squared Radio, just before Halloween. No trick, no treat tonight, just pure truth. This is where the past meets the future, and in here all the results are positive. We're trying to make a good case for several points of philosophy and enlightenment, and also to keep you aware of what's going on around us. And we have roughly 9 days to go in the general election here in the United States of America. We have a delicate and, at this point, tenuously balanced republic. It is balanced between the will of the people and the will of those who try to rule the people. We have reached a point in our country's history where government is no longer governing, it is ruling. I think you realize that. What you don't realize is that you have the power to do something about it. And not only do you have the power to do something about it, you have the responsibility to do something about it. We will not continue to defecate where we eat. We're going to keep those two separate. By the way, right now, did you know, because of many, many reasons, not the least of which is the amount of education and cost you have to go through, but also because of the liability, there is a shortage of doctors spreading throughout the U.S. And they make it worse, by the way, in a lot of ways. Even foreign doctors that try to come in this country, they're already doctors in their own country. They're already treating patients. But they come into this country and they have to jump through an incredible number of hoops just to be able to continue their livelihood in this country. And because of all of those obstacles that are placed in the way, Mary Berg, for one, is paying the price for a shortage of U.S. doctors that by most accounts is about to get much worse. After finding out in 2006 she had a rare and deadly gastrointestinal cancer, the 49-year-old mother of teenage daughter found out there were no doctors in Nevada who specialized in her type of tumor. Only one cancer center took her insurance. And because the tumor had spread, the need for a liver transplant was a distinct possibility, though no surgeons in the state were qualified to do the procedure. She had to give up her house and move to Arizona to get the care she needed. Once a problem limited to rural areas, doctor shortages are now hitting large population centers such as Las Vegas and Detroit, where people may have to wait weeks or months or travel hundreds of miles for care. Nationwide, there is a shortage of more than 13,000 doctors, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that represents medical schools. That shortfall is expected to grow tenfold to 130,000 doctors within 12 years as the U.S. population ages and 30 million more people are added to the insurance rolls under the 2010 healthcare law, the Medical College Association said. In the Las Vegas area, with about 2 million people, patients and doctors said it can add 6 months to see a primary care doctor for a simple checkup. For more serious matters, the waits are far longer, more than a year. For example, to get an appointment with a neurologist who specializes in autism, long wait. Frustrated by years of not being able to get proper care, Berg and her husband decided this summer to walk away from their home near Las Vegas, which she says has since gone into foreclosure. They moved their family 300 miles away to Phoenix, so she could be close to a specialist and a transplant center. In a bid to address the shortage, the medical community has embraced the greater use of nurse practitioners and physician assistants. I use one myself, who can prescribe medicines and diagnose and treat many illnesses. A nurse practitioner and physician assistants work underneath a doctor. Now, they can do certain things. They can prescribe drugs. They can do basic diagnoses. But if it gets beyond them, then they have to flip it to a regular physician. Still, they are serving a great purpose. They've created what I call a doc in a box, which is kind of a street clinic, and there are chains of them around the country, and they're far cheaper than a hospital, way cheaper than going to see a regular doctor, like a third the cost. And prescriptions, well, you rarely have to have any help paying for prescriptions anyway. Most prescriptions are at the outside less than $100 a month. I pay about $13 a month for my prescriptions. It's nothing. You don't need insurance to pay for that. Come on, get real, people. I mean, for me to go to the doctor to see them is about $35. I just pay it out of my pocket. It's a lot easier than paying $700 a month for insurance. Who needs it? If you're healthy, who needs it? Anyway, the number of physician assistants is projected to increase 39% to 108,000 by 2020. By the way, it takes a master's degree to be a physician assistant. You have to be good, and all of them are. The number of physician assistants is projected to, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, to continue to grow. Still, physician assistants can't replace specialists as regional shortages of all categories of doctors persist. This is a national problem across the board, and it is going to get much worse, said Christiane Mitchell, Director of Medical Affairs for the Association of American Medical Colleges. We have an aging population and a whole lot of doctors retiring. We also have a whole lot of doctors quitting because of the price of malpractice insurance. Because of one recent presidential candidate here in North Carolina, we lost almost all the obstetricians because any obstetrician that delivers a baby with cerebral palsy might as well kiss his career goodbye. He's done. Lawyers will eat him for lunch. And there's just no way to survive doing that, so the obstetricians left the state. As baby boomers age, their care has become more complex and time-consuming. At the same time, some baby boomers are also doctors who are expected to retire in the coming years, according to the association. One in every three doctors nationwide are older than 55. Can you believe that? That's correct. One out of every three doctors will retire in the next 10 years. Hospitals are using video conferencing systems to reach people in remote areas. And we're not talking that remote. We're not talking about Indian reservations here. We're talking about suburbs. So maybe it's time to rethink the medical profession altogether. I'd like to propose this right here on X Squared Radio. You think about it. Now, come on. I'm a scientist and an engineer, and you've known me now for 8 years. We've been here on X Squared Radio, and I've published tens of thousands of papers for all kinds of Fortune 100 and Fortune 500 companies. I know what I'm talking about. No engineer knows it all. You can be an engineer over automobiles or airplanes. You can be an engineer over nanobots or super smooth surfaces or tribology. But you can't know it all. Well, I suppose some of us could, but most people cannot. Same with physicians. There's so much to learn to be a doctor. Why do you think we have specialists? Because once you become an MD, then you begin your specialty. Then you're going to be a surgeon. Then you're going to be an audiologist. Then you're going to be a proctologist, an internist. You're going to be a specialist over bones. You're going to be an osteologist. You're going to be a neurologist or a pediatrician. You're going to be a general family doctor. You're going to be an obstetrician or an OBGYN. Come on. There's so much to learn. So why not break the science of medicine apart? Now, they've started doing it with physician assistants, which are kind of a frontline triage, kind of a modified triage person. This is, it was discovered during wartime when people would come in masse. They couldn't all see the doctor right away, so nurses were trained on how to classify people in one form or another. This person needs immediate surgery. This person just needs morphine until they die. This person needs an IV, blah, blah, blah. And you could treat a large number of people in a short amount of time. Well, the science, the practice of doing that has expanded. And now, and I trust many of you have all been treated by physician assistants. You may not have known it when you went to a clinic or you went to a hospital, or whether you had a car accident or whether you had a burn or whatever. You were treated by a physician assistant at that hospital because there are lots of them that work there. But there are these doc-in-a-boxes, these clinics like Medifast and Urgent Care, and they're all over the place. Entrepreneurs have put them together. Why? Because the customer demand it. And this is a free enterprise system here in this country. And so with all of the same equipment that you would find in any emergency room, except guess what? No crowds. You can walk right into the lobby without an appointment, and in 15 minutes or less, you're sitting up on the table with your shoes off. And you're getting the care that you need, and it's affordable. You can walk in there with $100 in your pocket and you can walk out with the care that you need. And that's the way it should be. That's the way it should be. Health care has always been available in this country, and it's always been affordable if you're healthy. Now, if you have some greater thing, like you need a liver transplant, like Mrs. Berg, or you have a terrible accident, whether you have a bone sticking up out of your thigh, not a laughing matter, or you have cancer, or you have some kind of thing that's going to require chronic and long-term care, then you can bring the physician on. But that's only 15% of society. 85% of society can take care of itself. They exercise. They eat right. And they keep their weight down, and they don't smoke, and they don't drink in excess. These are the people that live a long, long time. They live as long as they want to. 60 years, 80 years, 100 years, 150 years. You can live as long as you want to. If you're in good shape, all your genetics are put together right, and you haven't done anything to permanently damage your body, you can live that way. That's 85% of society. 15% of society needs a little bit more care than that. Some kind of system can be put together to take care of that. Is it a right? No, it's not. Healthcare is a privilege. Always has been, always will be. The biological transducer is not guaranteed to last forever. And whereas we may live with, a few $100 a year of health care for our entire lives until we reach the age of 65, then all of a sudden the health care goes up to $5,000, $8,000, $10,000 a year. So over the last 10 years of your life, you're going to spend $100,000 in health care. That's what the average says. I promise you. Those are the numbers. Is it worth it? You want to spend that $100,000 to stay alive with some tube sticking out of your body or some drug that makes you have thoughts of suicide or wander off in the park somewhere and get lost or forget your name? The biological transducer wears out. It's meant to do that until we figure out how to switch those genes off for aging, because it just works that way. So I don't know what to do about the hospital and doctor shortage. The only thing I know to do is to make it easier for smart people to become doctors. I know when I got my chemistry degree, the first thing my counselor asked me is, when are you starting med school? Because I graduated in the top of my class, alphabetically. No, I got good grades. And I said, I'm not going to med school. I'm 38 years old. I want to build stuff. I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm too old to start down the doctor trail. And I didn't. And a lot of my friends didn't either. I had one that served 22 years honorably in the Navy as a corpsman, graduated, went to Vanderbilt in Nashville, and got his master's degree and became a physician assistant. He worked under a doctor for about 4 years, and then he bought his own clinic. And he's doing fine. And that's the career he chose, and he loves his work. Sees about 80 patients a day. Well, in order for that to happen, we have to have a stable economy. And that stability has been called into question of late. You know, it used to be our dollar was based on gold. Then, in 1972, we stopped basing it on gold. We took it off gold. We started printing money to pay our bills. And in the last 40 years, it's created quite the catastrophe. Slow but sure, up and down, we have worked our way up the ladder until now. Finally, we are at the precipice, a financial precipice that's become global, all currencies all over the world. Well, almost all currencies. One, the German mark, has been quite strong. It's been backed by a lot of value, a lot of gold. But guess where that gold is held? You're exactly right. It's held in foreign vaults. So at a moment when many of its crisis-hit Eurozone partners are left counting their pennies, Germany is seeking to count its gold bars. Mm-hmm. The German Federal Court of Auditors have called for the country's central bank to carry out a physical inspection of the gold reserves it stores at foreign central banks, because the precious metal holdings have never actually fully been checked. Germany's Bundesbank owns nearly 3,400 tons of gold. Like many central banks, it stores part of its reserves in vaults at foreign central banks, including, you got it, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the Banque de France, and the Bank of England. High-value holdings, Germany's Bundesbank stores part of its reserves in vaults at foreign central banks, including the Bank of England. Yesterday, Germany's federal auditors said in a report at the Bundestag, lower house of Parliament's budget committee, that the Bundesbank should, in accordance with commercial law, should negotiate the right to physically inspect its reserves with the three foreign central banks. Now, why would you have to negotiate that? Don't you just pick up the little white phone and say, hello, this is, Herr Frankenstein, I want to come by and see my gold. No, you have to negotiate that right because the gold might be dusty. We might have to clean it off first. You know, we are out of tea and crumpets at the moment. Can you come back on Monday? It also added that the Bundesbank had already begun to implement this recommendation. Well, the Bundesbank does not consider it necessary to count the gold bars or check their gold content itself. Instead, it accepts written assurances sent by the foreign central banks as sufficient. Oh, yes. Yes, yes. We walked down the hallway the other day, and sure enough, your gold bars are still there. Yes, not to worry. Everything's in good order. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Frankenstein. Goodbye. But in a letter seen by Reuters, Bundesbank board member Carl Ludwig Thiel wrote to Dieter Engels, president of the German Federal Court of Auditors, saying that while Bundesbank was discussing additional inspection rights, this was not so that it could make the kind of checks the auditors wanted. Thiel said such stock-taking was not necessary from a legal point of view and was also not possible at the foreign depositories. Germany has the world's second biggest gold reserves after the U.S., the International Monetary Fund is the third. You know who they are, right? The IMF. It's a slush fund. They create cash to pump into markets in order to keep them from crashing, like Mexico or Greece or whatever. The IMF can move money around when it wants to. Where do they get it? Well, evidently, they have a lot of gold. Where do they get it? I haven't a clue. Italy comes a surprising fourth with 2,451 tons, while Britain languishes in 17th with 310 tons. From 1999 to 2002, Gordon Brown sold more than half of the country's reserves from some 395 tons with prices at a 20-year low. Analysts say gold could hit $2,000 an ounce this year, meaning the UK could have sold its gold for $16 billion as opposed to £2 billion. Pretty interesting, huh? So I don't know. I don't know if they're going to get to count that gold or not. We'll just see. We'll keep you posted. Because if they can't count their gold, we might not be able to count our gold either. Maybe the gold isn't there. Ooh, I need to take a drink of water on that thought. Because ostensibly, that's the real value. This shiny metal, all of which in the entire world, if it was pooled together, would fill up about three Olympic-sized swimming pools. That's it. That's it. All the rest of the gold is gone. Where? Well, we don't really know. We know it's been mined, but we don't know where it is. I don't know if anyone's holding it on this planet. Maybe they're not holding it on this planet. Maybe it's not on this planet. Maybe it's off planet. I don't know. Anunnaki existed? Hard to tell. We know that the gold mines are there. Oh, yes. Going back over 35,000 years, South Africa, the Pacific Northwest, the mines are there. We've seen the gold removed, at least what used to be there. But we don't know where the gold is. Honestly, we don't. I don't. If I did, I would tell you. I'd take you there and open the door and show you, but I don't. In the news right now, there's this thing they call Hurricane Sandy, which is, they're calling it a Frankenstorm, because it may become the worst to hit the U.S. Northeast in 100 years if current forecasts are correct. I can tell you right now, it just feels like the media is desperate for this storm to be the storm of the century. Anything, anything to take the public's eye off this election. We have 9 days left. And the one thing that we really, 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 really need is we need a storm to wipe this election off the headlines so people will forget about going and voting. We need to shut down all of the polling places in the Northeast so that people can't get to the polls. Only the people that can get there are people that mail in their ballots or get there by bus. But yeah, we need to cut down the number of days that people can pre-vote. And I could just tell you, folks, my AccuWindow forecast is, and I'm here in North Carolina, I'm not at ground zero, but I'm pretty darn close to ground zero, and I can still see the moon outside. It's about 65 degrees, and there's a light breeze, and I wouldn't mind going on a long motorcycle ride tonight. There isn't a storm within 1,000 miles of this place. So that's my AccuWindow forecast. I'll skip through that a little bit. I want an update from California. Rollin, you're on line one. Welcome to X Squared Radio. How you doing, Rollin?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Give me an update from California. You don't have a hurricane out there, do you?
First question for you. Is Frankenstorm heading your way?
My AccuWindow forecast says no. There's no Frankenstorm.
Okay. I don't think there is either. Anyway, here's an update. I ran into this woman. Her name was Megan Harris. She talked to me. We were sitting outside of a restaurant, and we were talking about different things. She said her, and she took my phone number and everything. She said her grandpa was Willie Mulholland. That would be William Mulholland that brought the water to Los Angeles when it was a pueblo. She said she was born in San Francisco, grew up in Monterey, and her mom lived near the Monterey Aquarium.
Okay.
So she's kind of cool. The other thing was, I ran across this other deal out here. There's in the newspaper, and this was USA News, they said that immigration of illegal from south of the border is increasing in the U.S. Did you read that in USA News?
Yeah, I scanned over it. What did you find significant about it?
I thought it was pretty interesting because Jerry Brown, our governor, he's made it legal to give them all driver's licenses in California.
Well, it's better to have them at least documentable while they're, you know, driving a couple tons of steel around our highways. They're not going to stop driving, that's for sure. I don't know what the licenses gives them the right to do, but it's nice to have some kind of documentation on people that are driving in our country. Now, if you have illegal aliens and they're here and they're not working, then, you know, they need to go home. But if they're here and they're holding jobs,
they're going to be working so inexpensively that the U.S. people won't be able to afford to pay the insurances that they pay. Now, here's the question. In California, it's illegal to drive without insurance. How many of these undocumented people will be able to afford insurance right off?
Well, none. I mean, that's the thing. Here in North Carolina, we've got what's called a cancel rewrite state. That is to say, if you have, say, you have car insurance in Tennessee and you move to North Carolina, your insurance policy, even if you've had it for 18 years, has to be canceled and then rewritten, because North Carolina is one of the few states in the country that has what's called a contributory negligence clause. That says if you contribute to the accident 1% or more, 1% or more, then the opposing insurance company does not have to pay.
Really?
Yes. And if you ride motorcycles, you automatically contribute to the accident more than 1% automatically.
Wow.
If you're hit on a motorcycle here in this state of North Carolina, the other insurance company doesn't have to automatically pay. You have to sue to get your money.
Really? Wow. See, the problem here in California is if they give all these undocumented people driver's licenses and they're uninsured, they have uninsured motorists. So what will happen is the insurance companies will pay off on that. They'll just raise the rates on everyone. It's a vicious circle out here.
The uninsured motorist clause isn't that expensive in some states, most states. So if you're hit by an uninsured motorist or you're involved in a car accident with an uninsured motorist, then that clause will pay for all the damages to your car and the medical bills and everything. But it does not pay for the medical bills for the people in the car of the uninsured motorist.
Right. And the thing is, the insurance companies, when they go to the insurance commission in California, they can then, if they show a lot of losses, they can ask for an increase in policy premium.
Well, that's what it's all about, Roland. I mean, come on, they're in the business to make money, and it's about risk. If you're driving your car around, and, you know, in California, there are a lot of people drive expensive cars. $50,000, right. $200,000 cars, and if they get hit, it takes a lot of money to fix those cars. And California is a state where cars last forever. It's like car heaven. It's not uncommon to see a 1967 car in showroom condition.
I'm sorry?
I said it's not impossible to see a 1967 car in showroom condition in California.
No, not at all. No salt on the roads in the winter. Very easy to keep a car going here.
Exactly.
It lasts a long, long time. We don't have those harsh winters. I'm looking for a document. This is pretty interesting. UCLA, the neurology department, sent me a woman's document that was supposed to go to Bethesda, Maryland. And the deal was, it should have never came to me at all. So I've contacted UCLA numerous times, but they won't call me back, tell me what to do with this document. So I'll just forward it to Fresno. But they've now compromised another woman's medical record on a genetic study that was supposed to go back, and I was looking for it. It's called it's National Health Institute or something in Bethesda. So they track genetics as far as patients go testing and programs and all that. So my doctor's out here in Northridge, California, Dr. McGregor, and also my psychologist, Shoham Jaffe. They can't believe that the UCLA would have made this kind of mistake. This is huge.
Well, it's probably not isolated either, you know. We were just talked about a national shortage of doctors in the United States. There are some 13,000 shortages, and within the next 10 years, that's expected to go up tenfold to 130,000 doctors that we need in this country. And with the Affordable Health Act, it has had ramifications all up and down business. We heard AutoZone recently make a national statement that they're going to have to cut back all their employees to part-time because the new regulations in Obamacare are going to cost them so much money. One of the medical device companies that I consult with just made an announcement this week that Obamacare is going to cost them over $30 million a year in additional excise taxes.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was even more than that. That's probably conservative.
Well, see, those excise taxes, Roland, are put on the sales of the company, not the net profits of the company. If you sell a medical device, Obamacare saddles a $10 to $20 excise tax on that device. That's the retail price. You got to make up for that in your profits.
Oh, wow. So that's bad. That's bad.
And it doesn't allow the medical device company to pass that tax on to the consumer either.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that. You know, they will pass it on somehow. You bet on. They'll raise the price and it'll be something.
Well, you just wonder why healthcare keeps going up. That's why, right there.
Right. I agree with you 100% on that. And the deal is, it's not going to get any better. Here's why this UCLA thing is kind of important. In the newspaper, since we caught, they had an article. 2,200 families are affected because the city of Los Angeles says that UCLA and Cedars-Sinai have been to both those hospitals. Are too expensive for their insurance. So they're denying all the people who work for the city those hospitals. Now all these people have to find new doctors. Chances are it'll be at USC, which is a county hospital.
Well, my question is, why are the medical costs higher than what the insurance will pay? You know, I could probably go to those same healthcare outlets and pay cash. And I would pay about 10% what the insurance companies would pay because that's what they'll bill me.
A friend of mine that goes to Cedars-Sinai, he's going there for some medication. His cost paying cash, they're giving him a 50% break. UCLA would not offer that, but Cedars-Sinai did.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. You know, I go to the doctor and to get an MRI on my, I broke my neck riding my motorcycle back in May. It was a minor break. But the MRI, because I paid cash, cost me $250. If I paid for it with insurance, it would have been $2,500.
Oh, yeah, I believe that. Yeah, I'm trying to get UCLA to do a spinal cord MRI for me. As a doctor over at Cedars-Sinai, a neurologist, she said the brain scan was fine, but the thing is, it could be spinal cord related, the reason I have to use a walker. So my situation was, I can't remember the last time, and it may have been up in Oregon after I went comatose the first time in 98, they may have not done another spinal cord MRI since then. So I called the doctor over at Cedars-Sinai. She said, or her assistant, said, no, there's a second opinion that you go back to UCLA to Dr. Brent Fogel, who's my professor there for neurology. So I placed many calls, sent him emails, everything else. I can't get them to order an MRI of my spinal column or to tell me it's a non-necessity. They should be able to tell me one of the two, but
well, I don't know. I don't know anything about those complex things. I got a bunch of stuff I got to cover tonight, Roland. I always appreciate your call.
My friend Nicole, his birthday is the 30th of this month, and guess what? I'm going to get a Grace Slick signed album. Anyway, Brooke, have a great week.
All right. Thanks, Roland. Thank you so much for the call. All right, my friends, don't forget that phone line is open, 888-429-5471. We also have a new conference call line. If you need to step out now, don't stop listening, 805-399-1000, and then just dial 769-608. You can also just go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com, click on the BBS Radio phone app, the X Squared Radio app, and it will take you directly to BBS Radio, and you can connect that way and listen. And I also want to give another shout-out to my friends out at Truth Frequency Radio, Chris Geo and his wife. I got that wrong earlier, but it's Truth Frequency Radio. They're rebroadcasting a portion of this program tonight. We always appreciate them. Those of you that are listening on that network, you're totally welcome to call in. By the way, you know, there's a news story out there that there's a huge zombie alien planet that's rising from the dead. That's kind of a catchy headline, actually. An enormous alien planet that some astronomers thought was dead and buried has come back to life. A new analysis of observations from NASA's Hubble Space Telescope found that the bright nearby star, Formalhaut, does indeed host a huge exoplanet, which scientists dubbed a zombie world in aptly Halloween-themed video on the alien planet. This conclusion contradicts other recent studies which determine that the so-called planet known as Formalhaut B is actually just a giant dust cloud. Well, it's not. Given what we know about the behavior of dust and the environment where the planet is located, we think that we're seeing a planetary object that is completely embedded in dust rather than a free-floating dust cloud. Co-author John Deebs of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore said in a statement, it's pretty cool. The planet was spotted just inside a vast debris ring surrounding but slightly offset from the star. Based on Formalhaut B's location and mass, estimated to be less than three times that of Jupiter, astronomers thought the planet's gravitational pull likely explained the ring's appearance. But other scientists subsequently cast doubt on Formalhaut B's existence. Some have argued that the object is just a short-lived dust cloud, citing it the brightness variations reported by the Discovery team and the fact that NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope has been unable to pick up its infrared signature. But doubters also pointed to Formalhaut B's apparent motion, saying it was moving in an orbit too fast and out of line with the debris disk to have sculpted it. But the new study detects the planet all over again in a fresh analysis of Hubble observations from 2004 and 2006. The research team spotted Formalhaut B in three different wavelengths of visible light. The astronomers did not detect any brightness variation this time around, further bolstering Formalhaut B's planethood case. So there you go. Formalhaut B is an actual planet. Now, I want to talk about this movie that came out this weekend called Atlas Cloud. I was so moved by this movie. That's interesting to be moved by a movie. But I can tell you that, my sad muscle was just worn out in this movie. So many incredible things that went on in this movie, not just the directing, not just the acting, which was absolutely phenomenal, just phenomenal. I'm just going to read you some stuff about it. Watching Cloud Atlas, one sees all these times in its characters' lives, past, present, future. The viewer takes away the message that there is a connection, occasionally seeming simultaneous, that runs through all of the characters, across an even vaster gulf of time than one could argue is beyond the concept of duration. Halle Berry, in her role as Louisa Ray, a 1973 journalist, makes a common remark that comes close to being profound in this instance. Reading through some private letters written in an earlier century, Louisa says she's trying to understand why we keep making the same mistakes over and over again. As another requirement for being taken away, the movie is a multi-genre motion picture, and the same actors play more than one role. You got to check out these players for their character count. Okay, Tom Hanks plays six roles in the movie. Halle Berry performs six. Jim Broadbent, five, and he does an amazing, amazing job. Hugh Weaving, six. Jim Sturgis, seven. Duna Bay, six. Ben Whishaw, five. Absolutely stunning performance. Keith David, four. Susan Sarandon plays four roles. And Hugh Grant does six phenomenal roles. Leaving the theater, I paid close attention to the several people who attended the screening. My sense of their general demeanor and the comments I heard indicated to me the 2-hour and 50-minute film is not always understandable, but it sure does connect meaningfully. Another way of saying the movie moves you. Language and a few actors' voices are responsible for some misunderstanding. There's accents and archaic speech and patterns of speech that also make it difficult to pick up all that is said. But if you listen closely, and there are a few subtitles, Nearly all of the parts of the film demand that you listen, which is difficult to do for 2 hours and 50 minutes. I, for one, am going back. I can tell you this. The blade of the cutting edge of Cloud Atlas is bright and shiny and finely honed. It could be David Mitchell wants someone to know that the concept of eternal recurrence might exist and, possibly, a better appreciation for it is key in enhancing the chances those recurring mistakes, as referred to by Louisa by reading vintage correspondence, aren't made again. Now, this movie is full of quotes, full of them. But I'm going to read you the key ones that I picked up. This is the one that is repeated by a female philosopher known as Son Mi. She is worshipped in the year 2143 and beyond. But she is key because she says, our lives are not our own. We are bound to others, past and present, and by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future. Another is, if we believe that humanity may transcend tooth and claw, if we believe diverse races and creeds can share this world as peaceably as the orphans share their candle nut tree, if we believe leaders must be just, violence muzzled, power accountable, and the riches of the earth and its oceans shared equitably, such a world will come to pass. There's another character in the movie, Cavendish. He plays two age groups, one older and one younger. This is a quote from the movie. Behold your future, Cavendish the Younger. You will not apply for membership, but the tribe of the elderly will claim you. Your present will not keep pace with the world's. This slippage will stretch your skin, sag your skeleton, erode your hair and memory, make your skin turn opaque so your twitching organs and blue cheese veins will be semi-visible. You will venture out only in daylight, avoiding weekends and school holidays. Language, too, will leave you behind, betraying your tribal affiliations whenever you speak. On escalators, on trunk roads and supermarket aisles, the living will overtake you incessantly. Elegant women will not see you. Store detectives will not see you. Salespeople will not see you, unless they sell stair lifts or fraudulent insurance policies. Only babies, cats, and drug addicts will acknowledge your existence. So do not fritter away your days. Sooner than you fear, you will stand before a mirror in a care home, look at your body, and think, locked in a ruddy cupboard for a fortnight. In one of the arguments between two of the characters, when one said that he was going to do some profound moral good, the other said, you will amount to no more than a drop in the ocean. And he says, my life amounts to more, no more than one drop in a limitless ocean. Yet, what is any ocean but a multitude of drops? One of the characters played an author, said, books don't offer real escape, but they can stop a mind scratching itself raw. Another is, souls cross ages like clouds cross skies. And though a cloud's shape nor hue nor size don't stay the same, it's still a cloud, and so is a soul. Who can say where the clouds blowed from, or who the soul be tomorrow, only sown me the east and the west, and the compass and the atlas, yea, only the atlas, O clouds. You travel far enough, and you'll meet yourself. It's a small world. It keeps recrossing itself. One more time. Our lives are not our own. We are bound to others, past and present, and by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future. One of the comments listed underneath this listing of quotes, "Dear Karma, I have a list of people you missed." That's a good bumper sticker, isn't it? And one of the last comments, in fact, I think it was the last comment, and I thought about it for a little while, how profound this is, and I'd love to discuss it with you, 888-429-5471, anywhere in North America. Because if the cards had been dealt out just a little bit differently, I could have been you, and you could have been me. One of the things that I've realized in my short life here on this planet, I figure I'm about a little over a third of the way through here. One of the things that I find interesting is that it seems that those people with whom I interact with more easily, more readily, even though I've just met them, it seems that I've known them before. It seems that I've interacted with them before. The familiarity of their mind, of their thoughts, of their desires, and desires so strong in some. Even if I've met them for the first time, even if through the wonder of this media, this webcast radio media, we have met, and at some conference we physically meet face to face, we shake hands, we look actually physically into one another's eyes, we know. We know, hey, I remember you. I remember you. I worked with you. In some cases, relatives, that is, fathers and sons and daughters, wives, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles. We travel together over and over again. We interact with one another over and over again, and not always in the same roles. Some of us get the distinct feeling that a son or a daughter might have been a parent in a recent life or a distant life. And here we are interacting once again. This time the father is the son. This time the daughter, the mother. Because if the cards had been dealt just a little bit differently, I could have been you and you could have been me. You know, we think about sometimes about the Anunnaki having been here, having played genetic games with whatever primates or primitives existed here. Who knows? Who cares? Those primitives became the soul carrier for us. And in their genetic meanderings, explorations into whatever, whenever it was done, did they ever give thought to, as this being came forth from its womb, whether it was a surrogate or whether it was the actual species that they had altered or created, as it spewed its amniotic fluid out of its nostrils and gasped and cried and took its first breaths, did they ever wonder, who is that inside that biological transducer? Who is that inside that body? This is no mule. This is no dog or a fish or a butterfly. This is a thinking, doing, desiring, loving being. This is a leaping gazelle of imagination. This is a being capable of charity, capable of selfishness, of self-awareness to the nth degree. It is capable of such terror, and it is capable of such love and tenderness. Whether they gave that consideration or not, that consideration is there. That consideration is inside each of us. The reason you listen to this program is to have hope and control over your own destiny. In fact, the choices you have made thus far have led you to this very place at this very time to hear these very words. The realization that your life condition is the result of thousands of choices you made throughout your life. Even before you got here in this life, those choices led you here. They led you to that orifice that opened and let you into this world. In some respects, the choices your parents made have lensed the first few frames of your life. But your soul now shines its own light, and you can direct that light anywhere you wish. And that is the key. To fashion the wish or the will to do what you would instead of that which you would not. I'm just asking you to participate in the existence known as humanity. To postulate just for one moment, just for one moment, that the things that you take in this world will be removed from you in the next. Those things that you give away in this world will be yours forever. Those things that you conquer in yourself, that selfishness, that jealousy, that urge to possess, if you can let it go in this life, it will never be yours again. The reflex to strike back or to strike out first, to use violence to cause harm and pain, to realize joy and satisfaction in victory. If you can lose that in this life, you will lose it forever. Know this, true peace is not won through victory. True peace is won through mercy in both directions. Let's take a quick break. We'll listen to a little Alice band, and we'll be right back. I'm going to go somewhere. You need to come with me. We'll be right back.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home.
welcome back to the third and final hour of X Squared Radio tonight. It has been one of those amazing evenings as we feel the pressure of Hurricane Sandy pressing its way, you know, into the eastern part of our country. Don't really know if it's really going to deliver everything that it's been promised to deliver. I'm just not sure. My AccuWindow forecast is it's getting a little cooler outside, and I think it's going to be cooler this week. But I think that the press just might be desperate for this storm to be something that that perhaps it's not. That's just my thoughts. This hour, I want to go into a discussion. And I'm not preaching. Really, I'm not. I just want to go into a discussion here. The phone lines are open. You can join in if you like with your own thoughts. But the last couple of movies that I've seen, one is Looper and the other is Cloud Atlas, have really you know, got my mind going, got me thinking. And I think the artists have done a tremendous job in presenting their art. But also I think they're coming forth at a time when people are really searching for something. That's why these movies resonate so well with people. And all great acting and great costuming and Academy Awards aside, this was really a great piece of work, a great piece of literature. And I wanna discuss the paradox of reincarnation, or the fact that the soul, you know, may go on and on and on. This first portion is called The Religion's Paradox. This is where the master walked with Chester in the contemplation garden. Chester was looking for a good debate, and the master, well, he just wanted to walk in peace. Well, Chester tried to start something. Quote, if a true religion is a path to God, why not just one religion? Why do we need six or seven or more? And the master replied, there are nine religions, but only two paths. Chester hated having to probe, so he attacked. That makes no sense. Please explain it to me. The master smiled. You make everything so complicated. You need long logical explanations when things just are. It just is. Chester found that the master was difficult to debate with. The master never gave him anything to resist or counter. He had never met anyone who seemed to just glide through life serene and unconcerned. Finally, he resorted to begging. Please, you have to give me more details than nine religions but only two paths. The master walked silently for a while and finally asked, you want things categorized and labeled like scientists do? Would that help? Chester shrugged and said, how else would you communicate it? The two paths. The master said, I will do my best. I need to sit and talk. It's hard to talk like a scientist. I need to focus. The master walked over to a large tree with lots of shade and sat with his legs crossed. Chester joined him. It was much cooler under the tree. The master began. There have always been two paths. One path is the path of absolute awareness achieved through meditation, and this is the path Buddha took. The other is a path of faith achieved through prayer, which is the path Christ showed us. One path is with the Tao, and the other is with the Father. Another way to look at this is this. One path experiences God as pure awareness, called nirvana. The other path experiences God as having a human-like personality, such as Allah, Krishna, or the Father. Now, Chester tried to soak it in. It seemed to make sense, but which is better, he asked. The master continued, I'll try to be logical for you. Let's assume the statement that God created everything to be true. That means for eternity, God was before creation. This means the original eternity contained only God. The best way to put it in words is to say that God was eternal, infinite awareness, and perfect balance. During the original eternity, God had no personality because the personality is used to interact with other persons. God only manifested a personality after God had created a creation to interact with. Chester was stunned into silence. So far, the master seemed right on. Chester softly requested, "Go on." The master laughed softly, then continued, "The God awareness path explains Tao, Buddhism, and Zen. The personal God path is contained in the story of Krishna and Christ." Chester loved to find flaws in logic, so he pounced. "That is only four religions. You can't count Zen and Buddhism twice." The master paused and closed his eyes. After about 30 seconds, his eyes fluttered open and said, "The three threes. The mystery of the three threes will explain it." He shifted deeper into the grass growing under the tree. "Three primary religions teach reincarnation. They are Hinduism, Taoism, and Buddhism. Three primary religions teach of a resurrection. They are Judaism, Christianity, and Sufism. And three more religions are a blend of one of the two mentioned. You could call them blended religions. Zen is a blend of Buddhism and Taoism. The Sikhs are a blend of Hinduism and Sufism. And there is one more blended religion, a blend of Judaism and Christianity called Sabbath Christians or Messianic Jews." Chester challenged, "But that doesn't explain why you have three religions teaching reincarnation and three others teaching resurrection." The master smiled. "It begins with the plan of God." Well, the plan of God is a little bit difficult to explain. I don't want to get into it right here, but I do want to explain maybe a couple of sources here. First of all, reincarnation inspires a lot of negativity in some people, people that have never heard of it. I can tell you that the soul is eternal. Of that I know, and I think you do too. Your soul did not burst into existence when you suddenly began to breathe air. You have been before, and you will be after this. In what form is really where the only argument lies. So let's talk about Hebrews 9:27. This is a classic one. It's one that Christian sects and different restored religions use to refute the idea of reincarnation. It says, "Just as man is destined to die once, and after that to face judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people, and he will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him." Well, the logic expressed is that since a man only dies once, that this is proof that we only incarnate physically once. The argument goes that if we reincarnate over and over and over again, then we die more than once. This scripture plainly says we die only once. Since this scripture plainly says we die only once, then this scripture obviously disproves reincarnation. That's the logic. However, this logic does not hold up. The New Testament teaches that more than one death is possible. It's a different kind of death. In fact, it teaches that the majority of mankind is actually in danger of this second death. It's explained in Revelation 20, verse 6. "Blessed and holy are those who have part in the first resurrection. The second death has no power over them, but they will be priests of God and of Christ and will reign with him for 1,000 years. So in this verse, we clearly see a mention of a second death. Now, that doesn't mean two mortal lives, two deaths. Far from it. Why would the Hebrews talk of man only dying once and in Revelation speak of man dying twice? It's not a contradiction. It's made clear when Hebrews 9:27 is read in the context of what is actually being taught. the author of Hebrews 9:27 was not discussing reincarnation at all. The subject being addressed was whether or not Yeshua, Jesus, had to die more than once for the sins of mankind. One of the misconceptions about the sacrifice Jesus made for the sins of mankind was whether or not he had to be sacrificed over and over, like the sacrifices made in the temple were every year. From the Jewish mindset, this was a legitimate concern. The Jewish law required a blood sacrifice every year for the sins of the nation. But this was only a shadow, a likeness. The author of Hebrews dispels the notion that Jesus had to die more than once, and this is made clear when it is read in the context of the other verses. However, this verse isn't talking about reincarnation at all. If you read the entire chapter of Hebrews 9, you will notice that the subject was about whether or not Christ actually had to be sacrificed more than once. I would read all of those to you, but I think I've made my point. That's what it's about, not about reincarnation. Now, reincarnation in the Bible, biblical references that are not compatible with the concept of reincarnation. Here they are. God knew Jeremiah before he was even formed in the womb. This is plain biblical speech of an individual existing before birth. I mean, after all, how could he know Jeremiah if he had not been born yet? It's Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 4. Then the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee, and before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee and ordained thee a prophet unto the nations. Indeed, the reincarnationist can even find scriptural support for personal discarnate preexistence. You can take the following Bible verse as proof of preexistence. He chose us in him before the foundations of the world, that we should be holy and without blemish in his sight and love. That's Ephesians 1:4. Malachi, Romans, both state that God loved Jacob but hated Esau even before they were born. It just doesn't make sense that God would hate anybody, but there you go. These verses are highly suggestive of the pre-existence of Esau, a necessary tenet associated with reincarnation. Yes, it is, but there's also the idea that these souls existed in other forms, not mortal form, and that in those other forms, they established their will, their desire, their personality, and they established their differences between those that were speaking about them and themselves. So there are lots of verses that talk about this in the Bible, but the Hebrew Kabbalists interpreted all of this to mean that a generation dies and subsequently returns by the process of reincarnation. And the Kabbalists go way, way back. I'll just use one. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and turns to the north. Round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All streams flow into the sea, and yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. What has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Ecclesiastes, my friends, chapter 1, verses 4 through 9. Your Bible, read it. There are many other Bible verses which are suggestive of reincarnation. One episode in particular from the healing miracles of Christ seems to point to reincarnation. This is actually in John. And he was passing by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who has sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? Jesus answered, Neither has this man sinned, nor his parents, but the works of God were to be made manifest in him. The disciples asked the Lord if the man himself could have committed the sin that led to his blindness. Given the fact that the man has been blind from birth, we are confronted with a provocative question. When could he have made such transgressions as to make him blind at birth? Well, this is something the disciples knew very well. The only conceivable answer is in some prenatal state. The question as posed by the disciples explicitly presupposes prenatal existence, a pre-existence of the man in a state in which he could have sinned. It will also be noted that Christ says nothing to dispel or correct the presupposition. In other words, he didn't come back and say, "Fools, this man has never lived. How could he have sinned?" He didn't say that. He didn't say that. He said, "Neither has this man sinned, nor his parents." But the disciples knew very well that this man had existed before, as they all had, in a state in which he had a full knowledge of good and evil and could have committed sin. Also very suggestive of reincarnation is the episode where Jesus identifies John the Baptist as Elijah. This is a classic. This is a classic. You remember when the Pharisees went out, and they did several times, to confront John the Baptist. And it was always a semantic, pork chop slap in the face. Because John the Baptist didn't mix words. He would call them, vipers and hypocrites, and they really didn't like talking to the man. So they asked Jesus, "For all the prophets and the law have prophesied until John, and if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who will come." The disciples asked Jesus, saying, "When do the scribes say Elijah must come first?" But he answered them and said, "Elijah indeed is come and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah has come already, and they did not know him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also shall the Son of Man suffer at their hand." Then the disciples understood that he had spoken of John the Baptist. Well, we all know who Elijah was in the Old Testament, where he came down and called upon the Lord to come down with consuming fire to consume. Remember the bullocks and the water that the priests had poured on the wood, and the wood itself and all the water. And, that was Elijah. But how could Elijah of the Old Testament also be John the Baptist of the New Testament? My friends, there is only one answer. There is only one answer. And that is that they are one in the same, living two mortal lives. One as Elijah and one being born through the womb of Elizabeth. As for the John the Baptist Elijah episode, there can be little question as to its purpose. By identifying the Baptist as Elijah, Jesus is identifying himself as the Messiah. Throughout the gospel narrative, there are explicit references to the signs that will precede the Messiah. And I would venture to say that these individuals did not stop living there, that they have lived again. Maybe not the Messiah, but certainly Elijah, certainly John the Baptist, certainly these individuals that come into a new life, remembering who they were, remembering what they desire, and that desire makes itself manifest as soon as they step into their new biological transducer. And I don't mean the day of birth. Come on, you can't even wipe your own butt at birth. But in a very short amount of years, you learn to do that and more. Walk and talk and then think and then reason. And somewhere around the age of 8 or 9, you become self-aware. You realize who you are. And somewhere in the next 8 years, by the age 16, you realize there's something great that you have to do while you're here. And if you don't fall asleep in the next 3 or 4 years, by the time you're 19 or 20 and fall into the commercialism of this world, you will pick up where you left off. Maybe having learned the lessons that you should have learned in the previous life. Maybe having left behind those things that you took with you, lessons, so that you can stand upon those lessons and continue forward. I can tell you, as we put this evidence together, it's absolutely irrefutable. And the master goes on to teach And he continues, the student continues to learn. And one by one, usually just a handful in a generation, people understand this. As they read the scriptures, these things ring true. And they join one of the nine religions. They follow one of the two paths. They either follow the idea that some one man can die for all of the sins of everyone. And a sin is a sin. A sin is a miss. It's actually missing the target with an arrow, if you want to do literal explanation. But righteousness, it's just a move. It's just a motion in the right direction. We can do that by offloading the darkness in our lives. We offload our selfishness, offload our jealousy. Oh my goodness, jealousy and envy have launched more armies against one another than any other thing. Any other thing. If we can lose those two, we have gone. We have come so far as a race. But over the generations, a handful is all the race could stand on a planet. Now we're 7 billion strong. And for 16 years now, we have been connected. Oh, yeah, you think longer than that. You think the Gutenberg press allowed us to print someone's thoughts and spread it around. It only made a conduit for government propaganda. We still go through the same thing with our media, but there is another media. There's an amazing media, this media, the one we're using right now, this unfettered, uncensored, wide open media, unthrottled, unfettered. It's pouring right into your head right now. Sure, it has my voice behind it, but these are thoughts you already know. I'm just putting it into words and maybe a little sound in the background for you. Just to give your mind something to grab onto so you can say, I know this stuff. But for 16 years, we have now been able to finally be connected together in a way that's absolutely unregulated, and I doubt it ever will be. I think some countries have tried to get a handle on it, but these words, they will make it out. We will figure out how to do it. It'll go through media. It'll go through art. Some way, somehow, we will understand that these words are true. That these truisms, that our lives are not our own. We are bound to others, past and present. And by each crime and every kindness, we birth our future. We choose whether to commit those crimes. We choose to conduct those kindnesses upon one another. We birth our own future. We choose. We are the creators of the future as we experience it. One more time, I want to read these words to you. Souls cross ages like clouds cross skies. And though a cloud's shape, nor hue, nor size don't stay the same, it's still a cloud, and so is a soul. Who can say where the clouds blowed from, or who the soul be tomorrow? Only Son Mi. The east and the west and the compass and the atlas. Yea, only the atlas of clouds. If you travel far enough, you will meet yourself. It's a small world, you know. It keeps recrossing itself. And we just shrunk this world again with this internet, with this amazing neural network that connects us one to another. So I go back to that because if the cards had been dealt a little bit differently, I could have been you and you could have been me. That's kind of interesting to say if you're a poor person talking to a wealthy person. Why? Well, because that envy is there. That jealousy is there. You know, it's often said, he who says, you know, money cannot buy happiness, has obviously had too much of the stuff. There are many of us out here who are struggling. Oh, we're not struggling against principalities. We're not struggling good against evil. We're struggling against ourselves. We're struggling to overcome what we have limited ourselves with. We are struggling to be what it is we always desired to be. And we do not want to be dropped on any turntable and spun off of a cliff for some movie. If you recall from our first hour, we want to be in command of our own destiny. Well, you are. You are. Somehow you've got it in your mind that you have to own what your parents owned at the end of their life, at the beginning of yours. It's nice to consider 500 horsepower, sideways drifting tires, smoking cars in the commercials, but you can't drive one. Because if you look at the bottom of that commercial, it says closed course, professional driver. That's a fancy way of saying this is not reality. You can't own this car and drive it this way. If you own this car, you have to drive it that way. Because if you don't, the revenuers are going to catch you. And they're going to take money out of your wallet, and they're going to send your name to the insurance companies, and they're going to spank that rash for another couple years. That's not reality. Be what you want to be. Do what it is you desire to do, for good or for evil. Go down as the world's worst villain if you want. You can. I hope you don't. I hope as a race we have learned to grow beyond that. I hope that we have learned to love one another. I hope we've learned that the value, the entanglement of one to another is incredible. I had a street philosopher one time tell me, as I was wrestling with these very ideas in a very esoteric manner, by the way, not so much as to harm the petal of a cherry blossom. He said, Brooks, I want you to consider something. I want you to consider the soldier. Who abuses a young Vietnamese child and then shoots him in the forehead to leave no witnesses. You think only about the terrible crime and heartlessness of the soldier who has done such a terrible thing and who has to hide it behind his eyelids in the bottom of a beer mug for the rest of his life. But I want you to consider the beautiful offering of the Vietnamese boy. I said, what do you mean? He said, we all come here and choose which role we will play. And this time, the soul inside that Vietnamese boy told that soldier in a world before, or maybe in a state before this life, I will go down and I will be your boy. I'll be the boy that you abuse and shoot in the forehead. I will do that for you. It took my breath away, my friends. I could not consider it at first. I only saw the victim. I only saw the terrible crime that he had to carry forward, the nightmare that he would have to live through for the rest of his life, that maybe he would manifest in another way, in another time, in some other terrible fashion, perhaps taking his own life in calculated termination of his own misery. But I did not consider the boy. I did not consider that willing sacrifice. And then I think of the Christ. I think of the individual that became that person, that fulfilled that role, that spoke the truth and loved and healed and blessed as hard as he could for 3 years, and knew, because it was planned, because it was already written on skins in ink, exactly what would happen. and he came and he lived that life because he loved us. He did it on purpose. He didn't avoid it at all. And did he do it to seal the fate of those who did it against him? No. He did it to open a doorway. Because when one door closes, another door must open. But you don't want the hallway to go around and around and around between four doors, north, south, east, west. You continue to make left-hand turns until you end up in the same doormat over and over again. No, this time, when that door closed, another doorway opened. A doorway to the right. A doorway that got us out of that loop of eternal destruction and incarnation over and over again. That we can rise up and one day go no more out if we choose. To go no more out, as it is recorded in Revelations. To choose to become a pillar of heaven instead of to go back out again and live another mortal life. To realize that we are all joined together, not just those to whom we are born, or those who are born to us, or those that we marry or work with or interact with or have affairs with or dream about and have never met. Those souls are not the only ones that we are entangled with. We're entangled with all souls in the universe. And now maybe you get a flash, a grasp of the eternity that we're talking about here. It's an eternity that goes beyond your imagination. And the idea is to not give up, of course not. You could always go to sleep again. You can always be born again or forget all this and wake up tomorrow and join the race with the rats again. You can try to fill up your 401k and your garage with toys. You can. You can continue to do all of that if you want to. Or you can rise up and you can leave all this forever and never incarnate again. I would not choose that myself. To know everything and to be sitting in bliss cross-legged somewhere on some cloud listening to a harp to me is not heaven. To come back here and talk to you tonight, where I know some of you out there are going to play this recording, you're going to listen, and a light is going to go off inside of you and you're going to say, wait a minute, I know this wheel, I know this maze, I am no rat. I am an eternal soul with an eternal mind, and I can open it forever, and I can comprehend everything if I want, and I will. And that desire is what can evolve the human race. I think, and I think you do too, that as we have arrived here on this earth at this time, this planet, this amazing, unbelievable blue jewel in the middle of the blackness of space, with the variety of life no other world is thousands of light years that we could search will begin to touch. Because this planet is getting ready to go through something. It's going through it right now, this year, 2012. And it will really come of age next year. Guess what? You're here. You're alive. You're living and breathing and conscious and aware. And you have full choice and freedom and liberty to do anything and be anything that you want. And guess what? You have chosen to be here at this time to go through this planet with it. You are symbiosis with it. You are in symbiosis with every other soul on this planet. And as this planet goes through its transition, and it's not a transition of one little tiny ball of dust around a main sequence sun on the outside of the Milky Way galaxy, one galaxy of billions in an endless universe. No. It is a change of dimension for all of us. You are at the apex. You are at the apex of this. And yet you have abdicated your responsibility, your duty, your honor, your privilege of participating in this to someone else. I'm just asking you to take possession of it one more time. Don't let it go by. You're not rubbing two sticks together to make fire. You're not scratching at the dirt for roots. You're not running through the snow or the desert heat for berries or running from predators. No, we've changed the whole world. In the last 100 years, we have transformed it into something we can freely travel. We can consume it if we want to. Or we can live with it. We can live within its system of energy and we can thrive. No, not to 14 billion or 20 billion people. 7 billion's about right. But we need to learn to live within the system of energy, generation after generation. Because guess who they are? They're us. They are us. The past generations, the ones that choked on the dust of coal. The ones that ran from and toward the arrows of enemies. It was us on both sides. Those days are gone. Peace is within our grasp, not through victory, through mercy. Not through war, but through understanding and communication. Yes, there are bad people in the world. I've already talked to you about them. You know what their plans are. I've already laid it out for you. So if they decide to pull the trigger and the gun goes off, but it goes off in the wilderness and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? How about if we observe something else? How about if we observe that we are all connected together and that we do not have to do this over and over again? Yes, we'll grow old as the older Cavendish contemplated the younger Cavendish in the amazing movie Cloud Atlas. If you weren't here earlier, I'll read it one more time to you. You will not apply for membership in this future, but the tribe of the elderly will claim you. Your present will not keep pace with the world's. This slippage will stretch your skin, sag your skeleton, erode your hair and memory. It'll make your skin turn opaque so your twitching organs and blue cheese veins will be semi-visible. You will venture out only in daylight, avoiding weekends and school holidays. Language, too, will leave you behind, betraying your tribal affiliations whenever you speak. On escalators, on trunk roads and supermarket aisles, the living will overtake you incessantly. Elegant women will not see you. Store detectives will not see you. Salesmen will not see you, unless they sell stair lifts or fraudulent insurance policies. Only babies, cats, and drug addicts will acknowledge your existence. So do not fritter away your days. Sooner than you fear, you will stand before a mirror in a care home, look at your body, and think, I'm locked in a ruddy cupboard for a fortnight. Remember, my friends, that even though you think your life is only one drop in an ocean, what is an ocean but a multitude of drops? I like to think about our lives are not our own, that we are bound to others. Maybe I would interpret that differently to say ours is not the only treasure to fill, that if we do not fill the treasure of those to whom we are bound, we have done nothing. If we consume others in order to make our own wealth, we have no wealth, because we have robbed from ourselves to give to ourselves. The misery that is freely given as a sacrifice for our happiness is actually the greater gift and the greater wealth in the life to come. The wealth that we enjoyed here, that meanness that you treat that waitress with. Yeah, you sense a little energy on my voice. That's not the gift to give. Now, do you have to give a huge tip? No, customary is fine. But if you just look her in the eye, just by your tone, the words that you choose, the gratitude for the meal which has been served, you can look into her eyes and say, I see you. I know you. And you know what? I love you. That waitress will go home and will treat her children with that same love. And those children will grow up to treat theirs with that same love. But if you're mean to that waitress, she's going to go back in that kitchen and she's going to throw her ticket book and she's going to say, I don't have to put up with this crap. I don't have to put up with some wealthy bastard out there condescending me and telling me I look hot or whatever. You've affected the universe, my friends. I'm asking you to be aware that you're doing it and to do it on purpose. Remember, I'll say it one more time, the reason you listen to this program is to have hope and control over your own destiny. In fact, the choices you have made thus far have led you to this very place at this very time to hear these very words. The realization that your life condition is the result of thousands of choices you have made throughout your lives. In some respect, the choices your parents have made lensed the first few frames of your life, but your soul now shines its own light, and you can direct the light anywhere you wish. That's the key, to fashion the wish or the will, to do what you would instead of that which you would not. Now, a couple of things. I know Christmas is coming up. It's a season of giving. I wish it was that way all year, but it's not. Not in our society. So a couple of gifts I would like you to give. Give the gift of a future, maybe. Not just a future for yourselves or your children or grandchildren or your friends or neighbors or people with whom you work, but also a future for the Republic. Two books. One is called Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. It has some of what I've talked about tonight in it. It is a book to help you create wealth and happiness and success in your life. You can get it by going to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any place like that. But if you buy it at my website, rememberingthefuturebook.com, you will get the audio version for free. Thousands have done it. I want you to do it too. If you'll give me the name of the person to whom you're giving this gift, I will send them the audiobook as well. So you can give them the paperback, and then you can give them the audio version as well. The second book is called Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. And this is a book that teaches us how to use a state-sponsored constitutional convention in order to save this republic, because 80 years ago, an agency government put in place, not designed by, but put in place by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, began a transformation of this republic into a fascist organization. I know that's a strong word, but essentially it's true. We have agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations that run our country. They write thousands of regulations each month which have the force of law, about which Congress can do nothing. Unfortunately, all of these agencies are run by not only lobbyists and corporate bureaucrats, but are also run by secretaries. The secretaries interpret those regulations any way they want, and the secretaries are always appointed by the president. They maybe aren't chosen by the president, but they're appointed by the president. What we need to do is take the government away from the executive branch, because the founding fathers knew exactly what would happen if one man gained too much power, which is exactly where we are today. When one man gains too much power, he can command the agencies, departments, bureaus, and administrations to rule over us. And that is not what government was meant to be. The agencies can tax us, they can fine us, they can enforce against us, and they can seize our properties, and we have no representation in that government. And that, my friends, is tyranny. And tyranny is the whole reason why this country was founded in the first place. Well, it's time to refound it. And there is a provision inside the Constitution that allows 3/4 of the states to call a convention, called a constitutional convention. And they can make amendments in this convention that can improve the Constitution and remove things from it that have led us into this abyss. Those amendments must be approved by 3/4 of those states. But right now, we have 80% of the states, 40 out of the 50 states have already passed sovereignty acts. All we have to do is get those 40 governors to meet, to organize the convention, to repeal those amendments, pass those amendments, and ratify those amendments, and it could be all done in a weekend. And then the Supreme Court is now empowered to take the agency government apart, return to the states that which belongs to the states, and return to Congress that which belongs to Congress, and rebalance the powers that make up our republic. Once again, we will be represented inside our republic. Right now, you know it, I know it, and the world knows it. We are not represented in our republic. By the book, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, learn by reading that book what can be done. Get it into the hands of your governor. Follow it up with a letter or a phone call, and you can make it happen. Great things have always happened when started by a small group of people. That we are, my friends, that we are. If you buy that book, Alienated Nation, from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or anywhere where fine books are sold, you can own it and you can read it and you can still have an effect. If you buy from my website, alienatednation.com, you will get the audio version for free. Every word of that book is read and recorded, and you get it as a bonus for buying it from my website. Plus, you get the book autographed. So take care of those Christmas gifts, and one more important than all the others. Don't buy those expensive electronic gifts. Forget about all that stuff that cankers and rusts and goes away. I want you to invest in something that's worth more. I want you to invest in food. It's a great gift, trust me. My friends, Scott Barzee and Danny Morris out there in Utah, have formed a company called The Food Investor. The link is at my website, x2-radio.com. If you go to the right side at the top of the affiliates, there it is, The Food Investor. Click on that. Go there. Start with a 72-hour kit. Trust me, this food is phenomenal. There is no preservatives in it. It's set it and forget it. You buy it, put it in a backpack, it's good for 30 years. So if this storm that they have cooked up is as bad as they say it is, and you already had this food storage in your possession, you wouldn't have a worry in the world, because you could eat and it would be delicious. It wouldn't be that pasty MRE stuff that's out there. This is gourmet, delicious food. And it's good for 30 years, and it's in a very lightweight package. I've got a couple of them. I love them. So go to the food investor at x2-radio.com and enjoy, I should say, bon appetit, even though we're talking about survival food. It's great stuff. So, listen, I really appreciate you guys being part of X Squared Radio. We've been part of the PBS Radio audience now for almost 8 years. This September makes 8 years. Wow, that's a long time. I guess we're one of the first. I don't know if we're the only one of the original crew that's here, but it's been a great ride. And I honestly can tell you, I'm going to do this the rest of my life. As long as PBS Radio is around, I'll be doing it. And I also really appreciate my friends down at Truth Frequency Radio. They gave me a chance to be on their program several times. And it's been a big help to be able to tell the story here. And we've also brought quite a few other hosts on. And if you have what you think it takes to be a talk radio host, get with me. I'll be happy to sponsor you. And we can get you on the air and see if you have what it takes. It's fun. Not easy to do a three-hour program, but that's okay. I would appreciate having your voice out there anyway. Next month is November. We're going to be talking a lot about Thanksgiving and other things. I hope – oh, by the way, don't forget, November 10th, I will be at the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference in Holland. Those of you that are listening in Europe, we have a huge following in Wales. We're actually the number one webcast radio program in Wales. Woohoo! Big celebrations. We love our Welsh listeners. I'm from Stranraer, Scotland, so we're kind of cousins. Anyway, make your way over to Holland and check it out. The link is on the website, the Breakthrough Energy Movement Conference. We're going to be talking about the global energy grid, and we're going to be talking about the advent of free and alternative energies that are going to break through and maybe change the way that we light our houses and live with our planet. I know you'll enjoy that. I'm going to be in India next month, so I'll be traveling to Holland from Mumbai and then back to Mumbai. We're working on the electric trucks. Yes, they're getting ready to come out finally. It's been a long challenge, and we've enjoyed the challenge, but definitely want to manifest just the way we did in Remembering the Future. Big things take a tremendous amount of big resonation. That's what it's all about. We keep that going, and we can make it happen. Any more questions? We have about 3 minutes left. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Really appreciate you guys being out there. By the way, oh, I also forgot to mention, I appreciate the emails. I got a bunch of emails when we were at the Conscious Life Expo a couple of weeks ago down in Los Angeles. Really great people down there. Robert Quicksilver did a wonderful job. We hope to be back there in February to talk about the Hollow Earth Expedition. Lots and lots of people involved with that. We have been in contact with the charter company. The boat is available. It's a bigger boat. We have 124 spaces instead of 100. That excites us very much because we have about 2,000 people that have applied for those 124 spaces, and we're trying to get all 124 people on that boat without a penny out of their pocket. That way we get the people we want to be on the boat instead of the people like rich tourists that, you know, chose their way into it. Remember, I've recommended the movie. Get out there and see Cloud Atlas. You better eat before you go because it's 2 hours and 50 minutes. Don't eat anything heavy because this movie really requires your attention. See it as a matinee because you're definitely going to see it again. And we'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
time.